You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show. Hunter found Ben Dyson, and that's our guest.
To be fair, actually, my father found Ben Dyson. You know, my dad is used to work for Brian's dad, just as I now work for Brian. It's a generational thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you work for me.
But you know,
thank God you work for me. If that's what you call it, I don't know what my podcast would be without you.
But you know, both Brian's dad and my dad work for Citibank, so obviously they have a lot of interest in money and how it works and
you
all that
stuff. You call your dad
dad.
I call my dad daddy, but keep going.
That's because he makes you call him daddy.
I make my women call me daddy.
That's right. But so, you know, I mean, that's the thing. My dad basically directed me to Positive Money, and which is Ben's site. And then I read Modernizing Money, his book, and here we are.
Yeah, and so we were talking before we got on air. Ben Dyson, welcome. Tell us a little bit about your background, and then we're gonna talk about the problem. Can you hear us?
Sorry, give me just 1 minute. I just need to move to a different room.
No problem. Thanks.
Ben Dyson is moving around his palatial mansion. He's currently moving from the pool room, which has a swimming pool in it.
The drawing room. We call it the drawing room.
To the pool room, which has a billiards table in it.
Naturally.
So from pool room to pool room.
It's amazing how an English accent... the video turned off, but it's amazing how an English accent can really... kind of give credence. It just sounds like people are smarter when they speak in an English accent. I'm always listening. I just like hearing
that goes
them talk.
Back to Bert Fox, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point. Is that language is identity, and when you speak with an English accent, people assume you're in an educated and all that sort of stuff.
By the way, they don't have the accent.
Yeah,
we're the
sorry
ones
about
with
that.
The accent.
Yeah.
Hey Ben, no worries. We said he's moving around his palatial mansion right now. So there it is.
Right. Okay. There we go.
He's like, yeah, right. Okay. At least there's a painting of a picture of a flower behind you. So it's a sexy backdrop, my friend. So let's get into this. So talk to us a little bit about what got you to write the book.
Okay. Well, I started looking into this whole money thing about 5 years ago. And actually, whilst I was at university, I just stumbled across a book, which is called The Grip of Death. And it's a play on the origins of the word mortgage. And really, it was
Can we just break that down? So mortgage, M-O-R-T, is death in French. And I'm guessing gage is grip. Is that
right? Yeah, exactly. So it was.
That's cool. I never knew that. Mortgage.
Yeah, thank you.
Mais le mortgage. It's my French accent, dude. Keep going.
Well, yeah, exactly. So people didn't used to have mortgages in the past. The mortgage initially was if you got into financial difficulty, you would take out a loan, and the deal would be if you couldn't repay the loan, the bank or the lender would take your house. Mortgages traditionally were just a sort of an emergency measure, and it wasn't the case that everybody had one. What this book explained was the way that we've got from that situation to the situation where everybody has a mortgage, everybody has debt, everybody spends most of their lives paying off this debt. And it really explains something about the way the banking system works, about the way that money is actually created. And that's something that very few people think about.
Yeah, well, it's your contention that debt is not a good thing, or too much debt is not a good thing. I mean, because you know, part of the reason people can afford their own house and a car and all those things is that we have a system of debt that seems by and large to work, at least insofar as getting people the lifestyle that they so badly need or crave or whatever. Isn't there something called responsible debt?
Well, yeah. I mean, there is such a thing as too much debt. The point is, in the current system, it's, you know, on an individual level, you can say, oh, I'm not going to borrow. I'm not going to take out all this debt. The actual system as a whole is designed so that people have to get into debt. And the reason for that is that money is created when banks make loans. So, you know, when you walk into a bank to take out a mortgage, that money isn't coming from somebody's life savings. It's actually just new money that's created through a simple accounting process by the bank. So you walk out of there with these new numbers in your bank account, and that is actually brand new money that has effectively come from nowhere.
Yeah, that's what I thought was really interesting. Is you said that banks, most of the money doesn't come from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve prints money, but banks actually create most of the money in the system, even though that money doesn't actually exist. It's like you said, it's just a bunch of numbers on a piece of paper, which is essentially an IOU slip, right?
Yeah, well nowadays it's a bunch of numbers in a computer.
Exactly.
Right, and so, I mean, just in terms of the statistic that really blew both Brian and I away, something like 3% of the currency is made by the Bank of England or, you know, the U.S. Treasury or whatever it is, and 97% or so of that currency is made by high street banks, Main Street banks.
Yeah, that's right. And everybody, you know, because it says the Federal Reserve on every single dollar note that you look at, everybody has this idea that only the central bank can create money. And if you create your own money, you'll get the police coming through the door. Now, yeah, as you said, 97% of money is not created by the government, not created by the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England. It's actually created by, you know, the banks that you see in town every day.
Yeah, and the issue is not so much debt per se, it's that we have debt-based money. Like our money, rather than being based on sort of positive resources, which is why it's called positive money, is actually based on debt.
Yeah, exactly. All of the money.
Explain that.
And explain fractional reserve banking, because I mean that I think that's the key concept that we have to get at here.
Well, actually, the history of this is quite interesting, how we got from a point. So, I mean, if you go back a couple of hundred years, it was usually the case that only the king or the government would create money. And so in the UK, for example, which is the situation that I know about, the king used to create all the coins. And it was only the coins that were actually legal, a legal form of money. Now, people used to put the coins into goldsmiths. Goldsmiths were the early day bankers. So you'd put your coins with the goldsmith to keep them safe.
Must have been hard to be a stripper back then. You'd need a pouch. You'd have to have a pouch on your hip. But keep going. This is where my mind goes, but keep going.
They would have
I'll shower you with gold coins and hurt you. Anyway, sorry, Ben. We're talking about an important subject here.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Well, sure. When you put your coins into the early day banks, they give you a piece of paper. So I would say you've deposited £5 or $5. And over time, people, you know, instead of going back for the coins, they just use a piece of paper to make payments when they're going around the village. Mm-hmm. So these bits of paper that the banks were printing became more useful as a form of money than the actual coins that were created by the government.
Yeah.
And of course, the banks then realized, actually, we could just write anything on a piece of paper and people would trust that there's actually some money in the bank. So they started actually making their loans by not lending money that somebody else had given to them, but by just writing out more pieces of paper with different sums of money on them.
Which might have been the first time that we went away from the gold standard, right? Is that
yeah.
True?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I understand, it seems that there was no way we were going to avoid that. You always hear people saying, we got to get back to the gold standard. Like, I'm always like, what are you talking? I mean, how are you going to get, you're going to transfer huge bars of gold from safe to safe? It just never seemed very practical.
Yeah, it never was, and it never works as well as people think it does. Hmm. If you look at history, there was always problems with the gold standard, yeah. With it not being flexible enough for the economy.
And for you guys who are listening, the gold standard, you hear this a lot among libertarians and different people, you know, different think tanks. And the gold standard is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, but the gold standard is essentially, if you're going to lend money, you've got to have the actual money, the physical gold in the bank to back up that IOU slip, essentially, right?
Well,
that's a simplified version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm an actor / comedian. Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, it was slightly more complicated than that, but basically there was a limit on how much money there could be in the economy because it was tied in one way or another. It was tied to how much gold there was.
Right.
And yeah. And so now what we have is fractional reserve banking, where what percentage of the actual money do they have to have backed up?
Well, it depends which country you're in. So in the UK, there's no actual percentage that's set. In the US, you have to, the banks, if they owe you £100, if your account balance is £100, they're supposed to have, sorry, $100, they're supposed to have $10 at the Federal Reserve, so that if you come back for your money, they at least have some of it.
So in a way, they're leveraging your money 10 times.
That's right.
And that's legal.
Yeah, yeah.
Which works, I guess, for the most part, because people don't want all their money right away. I mean, you know, most people take a little bit of their money out, and so you can kind of, it's kind of like you can, you have other accounts and you have other monies there.
But the point that, I mean, that is made so well in the book is that what it does is it encourages irresponsible speculation on the part of banks, because you give them $100 and then they have the right to make essentially $900 more worth of loans, right? And so the result of that, or $1,000 more of loans, but so the result of that is that in good times they go crazy and loan to people who they shouldn't loan to, right? And then in bad times they then make far fewer loans than they should, and that's why you get that boom bust cycle. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, that's right. That's the this is not a stable system. It's a system that either creates too much money when banks are overconfident, like in the years up to 2007, or it either creates too little money or it actually destroys money. And that's what happened since the crisis. When you take out a loan, new money is created. And when you pay back your loan to the bank, that money actually disappears from the economy. It's the reverse process to the money creation.
Wow, that's interesting. So in a way, it's better for the economy or the banking system or whatever to not repay your loan. I mean, to stay in debt.
This is the catch-22 with the current system is if we want to get more money into the economy, we rely on the banks to create it, so we have to go further into debt. And if we decide that we want to get out of debt, I'm talking about the population as a whole, if we decide that we want to reduce how much debt we have, then money will actually disappear from the economy, and that can lead to a recession. So we're in this real catch-22 where we have to choose between more debt and more money.
So if most of us took care of our debt, it would not be good for the economy.
Well, there wouldn't be any money left.
But I mean, and that's the thing is, so, when you hear what I think George Bush famously after 9/11 said, what should the American people do? And he said they should go shopping.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Well, so you're saying that the reason there'd be no more money left if we all took care of our debts is because the economy is relying on that constant inflow of cash or the monthly or weekly payments that the American public or the public in the UK makes, that as long as that keeps going,
it's not even
on interest, you're okay.
It's not even the payments, I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, Ben, but it seems to me that it's much more about the fact that you need people to be taking on more and more debt because that's how money is created.
Exactly. Yeah, we've got to take on debt faster than we repay debt. Otherwise, the economy can end up shrinking.
And that's why you end up with this boom-bust cycle. I mean, I think that's the thing is people look at the financial instability that we have in the world and we're trying to understand where it comes from. And it's woven into the very fabric of how we make money, which is this fractional reserve banking system.
Yeah, well, in the UK, in the 8 years before the financial crisis started, the all of this money creation by the banks actually doubled how much money there was in the economy. So, at the time, everybody thought, this economy is booming. And actually, it was all just fueled by this newly created money and all this additional debt.
And that led so much of this, so much of this sounds as though, first of all, it sounds very, very hard to avoid. And I can see exactly how it would have evolved this way because, a lot of banking and business, maybe all of it, I mean, the economy itself is run on a couple of principles. One being, I think this company or this product is valued at a higher number than you do, and I'm willing to put money into this where you're not. I mean, that's a simplified version, but it seems that a lot of that stuff is taking bets on, your own future, other people's future. You know, I think this company is going to do really well, so I'm going to put money into this company, and then you'll owe me money afterwards. All that kind of stuff.
But you've taken two different things, two different banking functions, and you've merged them together.
Well, I'm not a banker, bro.
But you're the son of a banker.
Yeah,
you know
true.
What
keep
I mean?
Going.
So,
yeah.
But I mean, the thing is, it seems to me like this is what I really got in reading Positive Money, reading Modernizing Money, and then talking to my dad is that banks have a function where they store value. You give them your money, and they're supposed to keep it safe. Then there's separately the function of gambling, speculation, you know, investing in a company that you think is going to succeed. And those are both things that an economy needs. But what has happened is that they've been blended together in the high street bank, and so that the average consumer is giving money to the bank thinking you're going to keep it safe. And then without them realizing, all of that money is being gambled with. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, the entire economy becomes based on reckless speculation, not sensible speculation, where you're actually saying, oh, who are these people? Do they have a good idea? Do they have a realistic chance of developing something that's going to pay me back my money? No, you're incentivized to basically invest in people with cuckoo ideas.
So Ben, explain that that is Hunter encapsulating essentially what you're saying there, and if so, can you give us an example of reckless? What he means by reckless in that case, as opposed to sensible speculation?
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, people still have this idea that a bank is somewhere you put your money to keep it safe, and the reality is that's precisely what you shouldn't do, because banks are all about taking risks. Now, the problem is we've mixed up this function of keeping money safe and providing people a way to make payments to other people, to other businesses, with this function of actually going and taking risks and lending it to people who making loans to people who might not repay you. Now, what happens is your banks obviously want to take the risk, because the more risk that they take, the more they can profit. That means that the payment system, that sort of function of keeping money safe, how well that works depends entirely on whether banks make stupid decisions or not. And banks making stupid decisions is a big part of the financial system. What we're suggesting is you separate out these two functions. So you have a service which is about keeping money safe, and a service which is about taking people's savings and then actually going and investing them and, you know, exposing them to some risk, but with the full knowledge of the people that provided the money in the first place.
Oh.
That's the, yeah.
Wow. Okay, yeah. And that was one. And when one of your solutions, or the solution was really, when you talk about that in the book and on the website, you're kind of saying essentially that something that a lot of bankers balk at, which is you kind of need a central authority to come in and do that. That would probably be who? The U.S. government, the European Union.
The MCC.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, okay, so this is the thing. If you take, by making this separation of these two functions, you actually, one of the side effects, and actually one of the main points of this, is that you stop banks being able to create new money.
The Glass-Steagall Act was?
No. Glass-Steagall was really separating sort of different levels of riskiness of activity. Mm. This is more about a distinction between the payment system and the whole investment side of the business. But what you do by making this separation is you stop banks from being able to create money. Now, the question is, you don't want to go to a completely fixed amount of money in the economy, because that is basically what you had with the gold standard, and it didn't work particularly effectively. So you need some kind of flexibility, which means you need somebody to create money. Now, the question is, who is that? Now, what we're suggesting is that you have a committee, which would have to be transparent, it would have to be accountable, have to be democratic. If you wanted to, you could use the Federal Reserve. Now, a lot of people would have questions about how transparent and democratic and accountable the Federal Reserve is. But you could set up a new committee. The key point is that these people would make a decision over whether to increase how much money there is in the economy. And the important thing is that everybody can see what they're doing and how that money is used. At the moment, the guys at the top of the big banks are the ones that really make the decisions that affect how much money there is in the economy and whether we have a recession or a boom or a bubble.
But don't those guys, aren't they more qualified than government bureaucrats? I mean, in terms of somebody who's...
Yeah, but it's a question of incentive schemes.
Yeah.
Their incentive scheme is not necessarily the financial stability of the whole economy. I mean, a large part of what 2008 was about, somebody said that, you know, historically Goldman Sachs' motto was long-term greedy, and then they changed it to just greedy. You know, and so
well, it's a very good company for a long time.
Absolutely,
I mean, as was Lehman Brothers and stuff. I mean, they'd been around for a long time and probably created a lot of wealth.
But it
seems to me that they, when they went public, a lot of these companies were gambling with other people's money, not their own money. So their decision making may have been not as prudent as it was.
And part of the reason why their decision making is so reckless is because of things like FDIC insurance. Right. What happens is because banks can't fail, the government underwrites them. So imagine a gambler who has somebody else's money and knows that if he loses all his money, the government will bail him out.
Well, that's one of the things.
He's going to go crazy.
Yeah, that's why they, you know, I've heard people use the term, you know, we were socializing risk and privatizing gains. So it's very hypocritical to me when bankers talk about living in a free market and capitalism, when in fact they are not being capitalists. In fact, half their system is socialist. Half their Bank of America can be as reckless as they want because they are way too big to fail. It would bring the whole economy down. So I've heard. You know, and so that does. You're right. When there isn't accountability, my big problem with government, with the federal government, is there just isn't any accountability. And if we have banks that are so big that they are not accountable to the very people that keep them afloat, you know, which is companies and individuals and things like that, then it's a big problem, right, Ben?
Yeah. Well, part of the problem is just this ignorance of how the system works at the moment. So most people, and this probably includes a lot of economists and certainly most politicians, don't understand how money is created. And that's why when you get things like quantitative easing, you'll have people, you know, up in arms because this is the government creating money and this is how you lead to, you know, a situation like you have in Zimbabwe or in Germany in the 1920s.
Hyperinflation.
Yeah. And what they don't realize is that actually new money is created every single time somebody takes out a loan. And the banks themselves have created many, many times more money than governments ever have done in history. The big questions you have to ask about money is who creates it, how much do they create, and how do they decide how to use it? And at the moment, it's the banks that create the money. They will create as much as they possibly can when they're feeling confident.
And by meaning they will lend to as many people as they can.
Exactly.
If they're feeling confident.
Well, so going back to the thing about the incentives and who has the right incentives to be creating the right amount of money. The banks really, they want to increase their lending because that means they're increasing their market share, they're increasing the size of the bank, and that means, you know, the guys at the top get bigger bonuses and bigger payouts. So all of these individual banks have this incentive to just grow, and the way they grow is by lending more. The more they lend, the more money they create. So when you add all this up, you have a system that is designed to just keep creating more and more money. And that's why if I could show you the chart of money supply in most countries, it's the sort of hockey stick. It's an exponential curve. It just goes up faster and faster. And that's because of these incentives that the banks have. They don't have any interest in what the effect on the economy as a whole is. They're not thinking that far ahead. What we're saying is that you need, if somebody is going to be in charge of creating money, you need them to have that concern with what's going to happen to the whole economy, and they need to know when to stop as well. The banks never know when to stop when it comes to creating money. And that's one of the things we're suggesting you change.
Well, and bankers, I mean, essentially bankers are being paid like to place bets, and they're not being punished when those bets fail, right? Like if you imagine a gambler who is being paid every time they put a chip down, they'd just be putting chips down all over the place.
Yeah.
And especially with, I mean, you know, you really drew in the book, they really connect this as well to CDOs and all of that sort of stuff, where then what happens is that, you know, again, that risk is hidden. And so much of it is, it's okay to have risk. It's okay to like gamble and to bet and say, I'm going to buy stock in this company that I think is going to be a big thing and it's called Google and blah, 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 blah. But you have to be upfront and know what risk you're taking on.
Right.
In the medical field, we would never, ever put up with the idea that a person would be trying out an extremely experimental, extremely dangerous treatment and for them to not know how risky and dangerous it was. Like, right. Risk should be transparent.
Mm. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with people, you know, if people want to invest in CDOs or, you know, any kind of financial products, so long as they know that they will take the risk, they'll take the downside as well as the upside, and that they're informed about the risk. There's no reason to stop that. There's no reason to interfere with that. When it becomes a problem is when you have banks doing this with people's money without them knowing, and with the federal government through the FDIC guaranteeing all of these risks. So basically banks can do what they want. If it goes wrong, then the taxpayer is on the hook for the losses.
Yeah, that sounds like a real problem. So what would your law look like, or what would it look like? I mean, would we say then to banks, I guess you'd have to have 10% of what you lend, 20%? I mean, are we talking about percentages? What does the law look like?
Well, the point is, should they even be lending money?
Hmm. Well, yeah, they can lend. They do two things. So, you know, you're a customer, you walk into a bank, you have two options with what to do with your salary when it hits your bank account. You can either keep it there in your sort of main payments account, your current account. And if you keep your money there, then that money is never touched by the bank. It just sits there. It's completely safe. It can't be lost. And it's there until you need to spend it. But because the bank isn't able to go and invest it, you're not going to earn any interest on that. So you've got absolutely zero risk, but you also have zero reward as well.
Right.
Now, if you say, I want to earn some interest, then you will need to actually take some of that money, transfer it to the bank and say to them, look, I want you to take this $500 and go and invest it somewhere. I know you will be taking some risk with this. I know that the taxpayer isn't going to pay me back if this goes wrong. And the bank would actually have to tell you how much risk you can take with different accounts. So, you know, there might be the one that is gambling on the financial markets, where they might pay you 10% interest, but you might end up losing 20% of the account.
So you're saying there would have to be some transparency and you would have a say as to what you would be willing to lend them the money for. So yes, you know, I want to make 10% of my money. It's kind of like what you'd do with your stockbroker. I mean, you would say, you know, let's get into swaps or options, or let's invest in this company because I think it's going to be good. And your stockbroker would say, look, this could be risky because, you know, for a lot of reasons, are you willing to do that? And you would say yes or no. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. That's the thing. It's, you know, you should know what's happening with your money. but at the same time, you should have that option of keeping it safe, but you should also not expect somebody else.
What are the arguments against? What are the arguments against that? My guess is that banks would say, if we had to do that, not only would it create massive red tape, major overhauls of the laws, major government interference, and ultimately it would stifle financial innovation. Right? I mean, isn't that what the argument is on the other side?
Well, the banks will say a lot of things. They, the first thing is, all we're asking banks to do with these reforms is work in the same way as the rest of the financial sector. Now, there's no, you know, pension funds, mutual funds, all those different asset management companies. They don't have the benefit of the federal government standing there and saying, if you lose your client's money, we'll use taxpayers' money to give it back to them. So the banks themselves have got this kind of privilege, which doesn't extend to the rest of the financial sector. So firstly, all we're doing is asking them to work like the rest of the financial industry. Now, the rest of the financial industry is really profitable without the same kind of subsidies and guarantees from the taxpayer. Mm. So if banks can't operate in this way and make a decent business, then they're pretty bad at the finance business in anyway. So
yeah, and so in essentially you're asking for banks to be less socialized. I mean, to be more responsible,
to be not socialized at all,
not be socialized at all. And
absolutely.
You're saying that you know, be in the real marketplace. If you know, be responsible to the money that you're taking from people.
Yeah, if you're going to gamble, right? Be honest about the fact that you're gambling.
Yeah, I like Ben Dyson. Yeah. I like what you have to say, my friend. I mean, really though, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense to me, because the rest of the financial, establishment does not necessarily work that way. I mean, that's a fact, right? I mean, stockbrokers, like the example I just gave, and give us some other examples of how other financial.
Although, if anything, to a certain extent, we are now making other financial institutions more like banks. I mean, that's the thing. In 2008, that risk was socialized.
Yeah.
To a large extent.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a thing. It's the reason why you end up socializing the losses and privatizing the profits is. Precisely because of this design of banks where they're allowed to create money. If you allowed the big banks to fail in 2007, 2008, the money that you think is in your account is actually just a number on their balance sheet. Mm. So if they go bust, those numbers effectively get frozen. If you remove the ability of people to actually make payments to each other, then everything in the real economy just seizes up. It's like taking the oil out of the engine of a car. You know, everything stops.
Right.
And that's why, that was the main reason why we had to rescue these banks, was because if we'd let them fail, the whole payment system would have collapsed as well. Nobody would have been able to make payments to each other. Now, the changes that we're advocating means that even if the banks make stupid decisions, even if they take people's money and lose it, the people who said they wanted their money to be kept safe don't lose anything because their money is kept safe.
Right, that's what they opted for when they put their money in the bank.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, whereas the people that chose to said, look, listen, in my savings account, 25% of this money, you're allowed to go and do things that you think will give me a 10% return, knowing full well that I might lose that money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's you know, so some people,
and then that would make sense because banks would stake their name on how well they did in the financial markets. They would you would say, well, dude, I go with Bank of America. I've been above market for the past 5 years. They're real. Those people are good. They've got great bankers who are really smart and take, you know, they're not risky. They're just smart about how they do things. It's exactly how you would choose the stockbroker. Somebody says, my stockbroker makes me money, bro. You've been losing money. Try my guy. He's way more conservative, or he's a lot smarter.
Opposed to not knowing what the difference is between any high street bank.
Yeah. And I don't. Right, Ben? I mean, is that kind of what you're, that's one of the, that would be one of the side effects of this sort of these reforms that you're calling for.
Well, exactly. One of the problems with the deposit insurance, the FDIC, is that no matter how risky or how safe your bank actually is, from your point of view, it's all risk-free.
Yeah, it's all risk-free. You're right. Right. So I don't care so much what they do with my money because it's going to be passed on to other people, maybe even other countries. What I care about is as long as I put my money in, I'm going to get it back out. And the government may have to print money as a result and inflation will go up, but whatever, I get my money back.
Well, yeah, I mean, your local regional bank that invests in local businesses and actually supports the community, and the Wall Street bank that invests in all the toxic derivatives, both get the same, you know, from a customer's point of view, are both equally risky because the government steps in and says, we'll guarantee everything. And that's really unfair to the, you know, the local banks, the community banks that are actually doing much better work and much more wealth creation than the Wall Street banks,
and because they lend to smaller businesses in their local communities, etc. Right?
Yeah, yeah, and this is one of the things that people have got to get clear. Most of us, you know, most people in the street still have this idea that what banks do is take money from savers and then go and invest it in businesses, and that is such a tiny part of what banks do nowadays. I don't know the figures for the US at the moment, but in the UK, just 12% of bank loans go to businesses.
Wow.
More than 50% of it is going directly into residential and commercial property, just into the, you know, the real estate market.
And what does that do to the real estate market?
Well, it pushes up house prices. This is the reason why housing is
because
so
essentially
expensive.
It's so easy to get a loan, or at least it's cheap to get a loan. That what you're saying is they're keeping interest rates low so that money is cheaper to borrow, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's happening now.
But that
yeah.
that's not such a bad thing, is it? I mean, it
driving
does...
up house prices so that people can't afford houses. I mean, Brian, that's the thing. Is that
well? Is it driving up house prices though? In terms of it may be driving up house prices, but it's also making money more available so that I can get a mortgage and buy a house. For you know, I can buy a nicer house and because my interest payment is lower than it would be. So.
But the point is that when banks are able to create all this money,
yeah.
the house that would have cost you maybe three times your income now costs you six times.
I got you. Because they make money on keeping you in debt.
Yeah, because they flooded the system with cash. There's right. so much cash available that like that the prices go up, and all of that money is being flooded into that system.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. The more you borrow, the more you end up repaying. So. The banks as a whole are getting more value from the real economy.
And that's why I really wanted to get Ben on, because so many of the problems that we are struggling to understand, like why are there these booms and busts? Why is it that so many people my age can't afford a house when in their parents' generation they could?
Right.
Like all of these problems basically come down to socialized risk, fractional reserve banking, what's happening in the banking sector. And, you know, Brian and I love this quote from this Lawrence Lessig book, Republic Lost, about how so many people are hacking at the branches of evil, but nobody strikes at the root. And I think that's what you've really, really done with positive money and modernizing money. Like, that is the root issue of the financial sector.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're trying to do, really, is look at, you know, what is the common root of all these problems? And is there one thing that you can change that affects everything? And money does affect everything. So if you change the way that money works, then it has this huge ripple effect on everything else.
How is your struggle going? How is this going? Are you changing hearts and minds? Are you actually convincing the powers that be in the financial world that you have a point?
Well, it's this is not going to happen overnight. It's definitely a long game. When we started out in 2010, nobody was really talking about this. One of the first things we had to do was a load of research to find out exactly how the system works today, because what they teach in universities is pretty inaccurate.
Yeah, your website talks about that as well. It's kind of like a it's like a fake. It's fake.
it's a fairy tale story of banking. So one of the first things we had to do was actually go through about 500 documents from the Bank of England to figure out how the whole thing works.
That was fun, and, right?
Yeah. Well, that actually grew into a book called Where Does Money Come From? Which has now been used in a couple of universities. It's a bit like a textbook on the UK banking system. Now, the reason we had to do that was because the Bank of England hadn't released a single document that explains how money is created. It was just the information was spread over all these different documents. Now, about 4 weeks ago, they actually released a paper called Money Creation in the Modern Economy, which explains exactly what we explained in the book. And it even references the book that we published
awesome.
As well. The former chairman of the Financial Services Authority in the UK, so that's the equivalent of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US. So this guy now is talking about many of the same things that we've been talking about for the last 4 years. He's actually going out there on the BBC and on national television and saying we're in danger of relying on banks to create all this money to keep the economy going, even though that was what caused the crisis in the first place. So actually, this whole discussion is really starting to get out into these sort of mainstream, high profile people. The guy who is responsible for regulating the banks.
Have you talked to? Have you had a chance to get any kind of a private audience with some of the big CEOs of these banks or the movers and shakers? Have you personally been able to do that or had a debate with any of these guys?
Not the very top guys. I mean, to be quite honest, you'll probably find that the CEOs of the big banks don't really understand many of these details of how banks actually work.
You know, it's funny that Michael Short's book, Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, talks about that. It was kind of what I came away from that book was how many of these big time bankers didn't know what the hell was really going on. I mean, they didn't know how the real system worked. They had a myopic point of view. It's like I heard a Vaclav Simmel, we were trying to get on the podcast, and he said, you know, when I was in the university, I noticed that a lot of professors it seemed like they were at the bottom of a well looking up at a sliver of the sky, and they knew everything about that sliver of the sky, but they didn't know anything about the whole sky. And that is a danger. That's very human, you know, I think, when you get so busy in your life and you can get very myopic and you're not paying attention to the ripple effect. You lose your macro perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, one guy that I have spoken to was a guy, one of the UK's biggest banks, one of the ones that had to be rescued by the taxpayers. Back in 2005, he was maybe one level below the board, so one level below the CEO. And he went to the CEO and the board of directors and said, look, if we continue making loans in the way we are doing, we'll go bust because we're making loans that we should never make. And he was actually fired for ringing the alarm bell. But I spoke to him afterwards about, you know, this whole thing about money creation. And even though he'd worked in finance for about 20 years, he'd never actually got to the details of how is money created. Mm. So even people at very senior levels in these big banks don't understand the details because they don't actually need to.
They don't need to. It's kind of like how these tranches worked and how mortgage-backed securities worked and what was in these mortgage-backed securities. There were really, according to Michael Lewis, two people that actually knew the details. I mean, they were financial engineers who were creating these things, and they're very good at math. But the numbers are astonishing how many people actually knew what was in these tranches, what was in these mortgage-backed securities that were being sold. And it was a one guy who kind of had Asperger's syndrome with a wandering eye, and then there was another guy. The characters are great in the book, but, you know, he does a very good job of kind of showing how few people knew really what the hell they were selling because they didn't need to, like you said. You know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's part of the problem with with the amount of maths and the amount of models that has come into finance and economics. There's a bit of a belief that if you apply maths to something, you can turn it into, turn economics into some kind of physics where everything has a rule and everything is predictable. And I was reading a book called Default Lines, or The Default Line by Faisal Islam. He's a TV presenter in the UK. And he explained that one of the formulas behind the Basel Accords, which are some of the rules that govern how much capital banks have to keep to protect them in the event that their loans go bad. One of the rules behind that, one of the mathematical formulas, when he told the guy who'd actually designed it that this is one of the rules that they're now applying to banks, the guy who designed this rule in the first place said, well, this is ridiculous. It doesn't even apply to this kind of activity, this kind of finance, this kind of loan. Huh. And so the rules that are governing banks across the world, the guy who actually designed the rules in the first place says you shouldn't ever use them in this situation.
It's madness.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that most people don't understand the madness, and I think the danger is always that we feel uncomfortable questioning the madness precisely because we don't understand the math and we don't feel qualified to question it.
Yeah.
But when you break it down to, I mean, that's why I keep bringing this back to gambling, because that's what, you know, that's what speculation is. It's a form of gambling. And it's okay to gamble, but you should know what you're gambling on. You should know when you're gambling, which most people don't realize that putting their money in Bank of America is a form of gambling. and you should know how much risk you're taking on.
Well, it's not a form of gambling for the consumer because we know that we're guaranteed by the federal government.
But the thing is that it is a form of gambling because ultimately, by having it backed up by the federal government, you're gambling with the entire system.
Yeah, the entire tax system, the taxpayers' money, and the entire
financial
economy.
System. And it also, I mean, that's the other thing.
And we paid a price for it.
And we continue to pay a price for it. And I think that's the other thing, too. And one of the things that Ben really breaks down in the book is there are so many knock-on effects to this. There are effects on this as well for the environment, which I think, Ben, would you be willing to talk about those?
Yeah, well, there's a few main effects on the environment from the way the system works. Firstly, because you have this kind of boom-bust cycle, it creates this real short-termism. So whenever recession or a financial crisis hits, that's a perfect opportunity for the government to say, well, look, we can't afford to do these long-term investments in renewable energy, in clean energy infrastructure, the kind of things that you need to do for the long term to deal with the kind of crisis that we're facing. And they say, well, it's a recession now. There's no money for this. So you find that a lot of the progress that is made on environmental issues when times are good can be wiped out in the recession. Now, the recession isn't necessarily some sort of law of nature. It's very much a product of this current economic system where banks are able to create money. And for anybody who's interested in the more academic stuff, there's a paper by Taylor and Schulerich where they analyze about 140 years, 60% of the global economy. And pretty much every major recession has been preceded by this huge bubble in the amount of money created by banks and the amount of debt that they create. So you have this boom bust, which leads to this short-termism, which means that we're not dealing, we're using money to rescue banks when we should be using it to deal with the environmental crisis. The other thing is just by saddling people with this amount of debt, it really limits what people can do.
Including move to another state where there might be employment. When you're saddled with debt in your house and you can't sell it, for the first time, it used to be you just go somewhere else and find work. You can't really migrate when your credit is destroyed.
It freezes the labor market.
You can't, that's been a problem in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even things like, if you want to live more sustainably, sometimes it requires money to do that. And when all of your money is basically going to the bank to pay for the house that you live in, which is not any bigger than, your parents' house was, it's just that the price of that house is more as a result of all this money flooding into the real estate market. So it kind of limits the options that people have to live the way that they want to live.
It's a huge, huge problem. But I mean, it's also a huge opportunity because if you can fix this, there are so many positive knock-on effects from changing this.
The question then becomes, I can just see, if you get it practical, I can just see the two camps breaking up about how you fix this. One side is going to say, well, we don't want any government regulation or interference. And the other side's going to say, well, what is the alternative? So what is the best way to do this? Is there a middle ground?
this idea that you don't want government interference or regulation, I mean,
there already
the system
is.
That we,
there already is, right? I mean, there already
huge,
is massive amounts.
Huge amounts of it.
And
yeah,
it's
I
also,
mean, the,
that's government,
you
know, that's
the Federal Reserve,
job.
Quantitative easing, the way this system is set up, it requires massive government involvement to essentially to stop the whole thing from failing. And if you... actually, what we're suggesting, we're not politically aligned either way. What we'd like to see is a banking system that is part of the private sector, where there's no socialization of losses and privatization of profits, and a role for the government which is about just keeping the system safe and making sure that the public are protected from the bad decisions made by banks.
Sounds reasonable. Sounds very reasonable to me. It does.
Well, one of the things you need all this regulation in the current system because if the banks fail, it can bring down the entire economy. With the type of banks that we're suggesting, where the only people that take the hit are the people that chose to take the risk, you can allow these banks to fail without the risk of it bringing down your whole economy. And therefore, you might actually need less regulation and less interference in what banks do, because they're only taking private risks. They're not risking the tax. They're not putting risk onto the taxpayer.
I hope you win a Nobel Prize someday. I'm serious. I really, it does. It sounds, it's very clear, and it sounds like it makes a lot of sense. You know, just because what you're saying basically is, look, just have transparency. Let your consumers know what you're doing with their product or with their good faith or with their hard-earned money. And if you want to take a risk, that's up to you. You're talking about individual responsibility, freedom, and choice here. That's what you're really talking about, and getting banks back to what they're supposed to do and putting their reputation on the line. It sounds to me like you're giving banks more responsibility. What I really like about this idea is I can see banks saying, look, hey, everybody, we made our customers this much more money than these other banks. You know why? Because we're really responsible. This is our long-term spreadsheet. Come to our bank and give us your business. It'll make banks actually have to compete in a real marketplace for real customers. I mean, that's what it sounds like you're calling for, or at least that's what it sounds like the effect will be.
Yeah, it's a very, very different banking system and one that should be much more stable.
And one that's more responsible to its customers.
And one that's much more based in the free market. That's the irony is that it's so easy, like as soon as the word government is mentioned, to think, oh, this is socialist or whatever. But the point is that this is talking about real capitalism, right? Let people risk, let people speculate, but let people pay when they lose.
Right.
Like, you know, it's okay to gamble, yeah. But if you're going to gamble, then you have to be willing to lose.
Look, man, just as a stand-up comic, my reputation, you either come to me because you think I'm funny or you don't. I mean, there's no lying there. I'm either going to make you laugh or I'm not, you know. Most of us live in a world where, you know, I'm as good as my product.
Yeah.
You know, and if I suck, you're not going to come back the next time. By the way, I never suck, Ben. I'm hilarious.
That stripper joke about the gold coins.
Funny stuff. Yeah, but the problem is I was getting so intrigued in what he was saying. It was so interesting that I found myself, that, you know, all my humor went out the window. I was like, this is really important stuff to get out there. And you're a young guy, Ben, so you got time to rattle feathers. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing that one of the other things that I would love to also talk about, I mean, the book is Modernizing Money, and it does a really good job of very methodically laying out the case and dealing with, I mean, there's a whole section that's devoted to what are the objections that would be had and do those objections make sense. But one of the things that I think is also just really important to talk about is seniorage. Which is not something that a lot of people know about, but essentially when you make money, you make money. So when you're printing money or when you're creating money, you actually get commission on that essentially, and you get to make some money. So by having banks create 97% of the money in the economy, that's a lot of money that isn't going into the treasury. So it also means that you end up paying more taxes, because that revenue, instead of going into the government, goes into the hands of banks. So just another consequence of how banks are basically getting this monopoly, this unfair advantage, and the public gets screwed. Mm. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's another subsidy for the banking system.
Gets a great deal of subsidies. They're just like the agricultural business, you know, our agricultural sector.
That's it. Wow. Yeah. The other thing is, well, the whole thing about the national debt. Now, the reason the national debt has risen so much is because we had a huge economic crisis that was caused by the banking system. You know, when that happens, people lose their jobs, businesses fail, and the government doesn't collect as much tax. If you had more stability, and if you didn't have the banks causing the crisis in the first place, you wouldn't have had the deficit and the need to borrow quite so much. The costs of the banking system that we have are huge. You know, they come through the national debt. They come through additional taxes that we have to pay because we're losing this seniorage on creating money to the banking sector.
And how big is that seniorage?
It can be quite substantial. We estimate for the UK It could be about 10% of the annual government spending budget that is being lost as a result of allowing banks to create money instead of the state.
So you'd be able to cut taxes by 10%.
Yeah. I mean, so if you take this power to create money away from the banks and return it to, either the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, or maybe you need to set up some new independent organization. But when you want to put this new money into the economy, your options are either to increase government spending, to cut taxes. You could even pay down the national debt, or you could actually just divide it up between, everybody who's registered to vote or everybody who's registered to pay tax, and give everybody their own sort of equal share and let them decide how to spend it.
Wow.
So there's all sorts of things you can do. But the point is that, again, it's really just, I think that's the other thing, too, is what is money? Money is a public good, right? It's something that is created it's a public resource in the same way that a national park is, or water, or anything like that. And it should not be, the right to use that should not be in private hands.
Hmm.
Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah, completely. Because
I never even thought of it that way, but that makes sense. Damn it, I'm not smart.
Well, here's the question. I mean, if we all know that it's wrong for somebody to print paper money and then go out into the into the community and try and spend it,
right?
And we know that's wrong because they get something for nothing. It's taking value without actually creating any value, and there isn't really such a big difference between that and what a bank does. A bank creates an IOU. It's just a number in a computer system. And
basically because they have a monopoly on the money already.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, the banks collectively are the only real organizations that can create money.
Yeah.
With the exception of the central bank. And because of that, somebody has to borrow from the banks. Otherwise, there would be no money in the economy.
Right.
What they get in exchange for making this money is all these debt contracts, all these mortgages, personal loans, credit cards, and the interest that we have to pay on all of this debt is what makes up the bank's profits.
It's nuts. I mean, it's really nuts. And I think that's the thing. I mean, I'm so grateful that you are out there and that positive money is out there and that, you're drawing attention to an issue that is really apartisan. Like,
yeah,
we can all agree that this is, whether you are, on the left or the right end of the spectrum, it doesn't really matter. The point is that this is about fairness.
Yeah, it's called transparency
and
responsibility and let the banks live the way we do. I mean, let them run their business on the up and up.
It's bad for innovation. Like, that's the thing. I mean, whatever your values are and whatever you value, whether you value, having a free market, whether you value fairness and equality or whatever that is, it also increases income inequality, by the way. That's something they lay out in the book as well. Mm. Wherever you lie on the spectrum, this is not good, the current system, and it should be changed.
Well,
absolutely.
It's amazing how you can lay out all that evidence and yet things move so slowly.
Yeah, but it doesn't need to move slowly. And I always think that's the danger is that we've been so inculcated in the idea that change takes time.
And exactly.
It's
a cynical
that's
point
right.
of view. One of the reasons that Hunter and I wanted to do this podcast and that one of the reasons I do it, we don't make any money really, is essentially this is the idea, is let's get these big ideas out there. Let's give a mouthpiece to someone like Ben Dyson. These are very important issues. And look, I'm just an actor and a comedian and the best ever, but still, but that's all I am. But I can do my part at least. I always feel like at least we're doing something here. at least you read the books and earn an opinion, but it's one thing to do that. It's another thing to actually take the time to write a book
and to read 500 Bank of England documents, yeah. which must have been a fun experience.
Yeah, you're an important guy, man. I don't know how you feel a lot of times. Maybe you feel like you're crying out in the dark. I don't know. Or maybe you feel like you're making real progress. But I, for one, hope you continue to make really real progress. I hope this podcast is the straw that breaks the camel's back, ladies and gentlemen. The Brian Callen Show.
Change the world.
Notice how I left your name out of it?
Yeah, well.
Power corrupts. I'm into it. So Ben, besides doing the greatest podcast of all time, what else are you doing to get this message out there?
Well, at the moment we do a lot of stuff online, with YouTube, with Facebook. We've got 25,000 people on the Facebook group now. Okay. We're just hiring some.
The problem is it's not flashy. The problem is that with this kind of stuff is it takes a little time to actually listen to and understand what the problem is. It's not a lot of time, but that's why it's difficult. That must be a little bit of a challenge to get people to actually, first of all, understand how the system works and why it is detrimental, and then to kind of get them to understand what to do about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That must be the challenge. Yeah.
It's harder than saving the whale or things like this. But the amazing thing is, like the kind of people that are interested in this, you'd think maybe it was economists. We have people from the age of about 16 through to about 84, 85. There are all kinds of people who are taking an interest in this whole issue, and most of them don't have a background in economics.
Because the idea itself is about fairness and transparency and all the things we grow up learning to try to emulate and hold in high regard. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like the idea that you're laying out is something called good business, and that's what it sounds like to me. That's why it's so important.
Ben, have you ever heard of a book called The Diffusion of Innovations?
No, I haven't.
It's by Everett Rogers, and it basically draws together all of the research on basically how do ideas spread and why do they spread. I wrote a book myself, and in the writing of that book, Everett Rogers' work was hugely, hugely helpful because it basically is like essentially why do certain ideas move and why do certain ideas not. But I think that's the thing, is it might give some guidance in how you reach. I mean, clearly you're already doing amazingly, but how do you reach that next level?
What do you think, Hunter? What is that? How do ideas? Why do ideas?
Well,
spread?
It's a cultural effect and it's a cultural force. And so much of, I think even what we've been doing in this podcast is basically frame it in terms of what people already believe. Figuring out what are those emotional issues. Like the point is that fractional reserve banking is an abstract idea. I can't dial into it. But if you appeal to, there are a lot of 20 and 30 somethings who don't have a house and they're like, is something wrong with me? Why don't I have a house when my parents did at this age? Mm-hmm. But if you dial into those really emotional issues of why don't you have a house? Why is there a recession? Why can you not move across the country? Those sorts of things. I mean, it's essentially, that's what Fox News does brilliantly, It really always dials into very easily very tangible things that people can understand.
Yeah, not that's necessarily a good thing.
No, and they use it for evil. But the point is that you can use the same force for good.
Yeah.
And the difference is that they dial into those things and then hook it up to an idea that has nothing to do with anything. But if you actually, there are things that so naturally, and what you've done in Positive Money, there are things that are so naturally coming out of fractional reserve banking that are tangible. And so I think that would be my biggest thing, is basically deal with the second order effects that people understand, really focus on those, and then filter them back to the root cause.
You see what happens, Ben, when you do the Brian Callen / Hunter Motz show? You get these ideas. We add to your ideas. I'm kidding. I don't know.
That may not be useful.
Hunter's drunk. So.
No, that's good. That's good.
Ben Dyson, thank you for doing the podcast, man.
Really a treat. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great. We'll have you back on as we get more into, as the world starts to crumble.
Remember us when you're famous,
been
Ben.
A pleasure.
Are you wearing a cape right now? You should be, my friend. Ben Dyson from the UK. Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time, man.
And the website is positivemoney.org, and the book is Modernizing Money, which is available on Amazon.
We will put that on our website and push it. Thank you, sir.
Oh, he hung up. Dropped the microphone. Oh, he's gone. Oh, no, he's there.
Oh, he's still here. Keep it going. We're not done with the podcast. Ben, thank you.
I thought there was a silence at the end of the show.
Yeah, well, there's a small lull at the end of it. Yeah. You're a good man, bro. Thank you so much for your time. Do you ever come to LA or New York?
I haven't been that far over. Furthest I've been is Chicago.
Let us know.
Yeah, sometime.
We will roll out the carpet for you.
Excellent.
Keep doing what you're doing. We need you.
Cheers. Thanks all a lot. Good to speak to you.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.
It's great.
Yeah, awesome, right?
Yeah, man. Thank you. Thank you, Hunter Motz, for getting yet another person.
Thank Yob Motz.
Yob Motz. Hunter and Yob. Your dad's name is Yob.
Yeah, that's this is something I've never understood. Why would you name your child after the most depressing book of the Bible?
Does your mom listen to our podcast?
She does, actually. She does. Well, yeah.
Peggy Motz, Yob Motz, you've done well with this boy with a big brain and a big head and a big tailpiece.
Well, mostly the big tailpiece.
You got an ass on you.
I do. Brendan Schaub has commented on it.
He's called you the tailpiece, and you got straight white teeth. Well done. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for us. Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.